In Akron, a campaign to grow 100,000 new trees in the region is launching with a weekend event to teach residents how to grow and care for trees. It's all being done in an effort to combat a dwindling tree canopy. And the effort is similar in Cleveland and Cuyahoga County, where neighborhoods that have been historically redlined are forced to coexist with industry, have worse air quality and health outcomes. Welcome to The Sound of Ideas. I'm Jenny Himmel. Today is the final conversation in our week-long series on environmental issues in honor of Earth Day. We're going to talk about air quality in our urban areas of Cleveland and Akron, and we'll talk about efforts to expand the tree canopy. Later, a conversation with Ohio native and USAID Deputy Administrator Mark Simakovsky about Russia's war with Ukraine. Those conversations are coming up. First, the news. It's The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for joining us on this Thursday. According to the American Lung Association's 25th Annual State of the Air Report, released just this week, the Cleveland metropolitan area ranked 31st worst in the nation for ozone pollution. The ranking is based on Cuyahoga County's average number of unhealthy days of the year, which is 5.8. Now, there was a slight improvement from last year, but still the region received an F grade for essentially the amount of smog, in the air. And where is this hitting hardest? Studies have shown that even decades later, neighborhoods that have historically been redlined or were subject to race-based housing discrimination are linked to worse outcomes in a variety of ways, including air quality. One is that their air quality and they deal with more pollution. The other, they're generally hotter and can be described as intensified heat islands. It's not surprising, perhaps, that redlined areas also deal with tree canopy loss. That's true on a national level, and the same can be said for our big cities like Cleveland and Akron. A way to combat poor air quality, higher levels of asthma for kids, and these intense heat islands is to plant more trees. In Akron, a new initiative called Planting Change aims to plant 100,000 trees by 2034 to respond to a declining tree canopy. As part of the weekend, Keep Akron Beautiful is teaching residents of Akron how to plant and care for trees in their yards and communities. Now, today is the final installment of our week-long series of environmental conversations. In celebration of Earth Day this week, we're going to talk about air quality in the wider region and, of course, the efforts to make the environment cleaner and more breathable with a larger tree canopy. To have this conversation, I am joined in studio by Christina Yoka, Chief of Air Pollution Outreach with the Cleveland Health Department. Welcome, Christina.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for coming in. We also have Tom Scheiber, Manager of Community Forestry with the Western Reserve Land Conservancy. Tom, thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Glad to have both of you. And finally, by phone, we have Beth Vild. She's the COO and Director of Programming at the Big Love Network. Thanks for joining us, Beth.
Thanks for having me.
And if you'd like to join in the conversation or have a question, we'd love to hear from you. You can call us at 866-578-0903. That's 866-578-0903. Or you can send an email to soi@ideastream.org. So, Christina, I started with, I guess you could call it bad news, the American Lung Association's ranking of Cleveland, the metropolitan area, 31st in the nation for ozone pollution. Does that track with your department's analysis?
So, thank you for asking about that. That lung report is always a really important document and report that comes out each year. And it is helpful in showing how things are changing, where there have been improvements made. And so what that is referencing is our ozone days. And in terms of what they reported, yes, those days are accurate. And that's based off of something called the Air Quality Index. And the Air Quality Index is basically a measurement of how good or bad the air quality is on a given day. So you might have seen these, like if you have a smartphone, you'll see an air quality alert come up. That's where it's coming from. So our office, we operate an ambient air monitoring network throughout Cuyahoga County that collects that information. And so what they've reported is, yes, it's true. It is true as well that things have improved. Are we where we need to be? No, there's still some concerns, but it is an accurate report.
And if you were to describe to the layperson kind of where generally is the air the worst and where is it good in the region, in the greater Cleveland area, how would you describe that?
With that specific concern, ozone, it's a tricky pollutant because it's what's considered a regional pollutant. So that means that it's the greater Cleveland area is impacted by it. But what we are seeing is that where there are areas of poor air quality, it tends to be around high transportation areas, so around all of our highway systems, and it tends to be around where there is greater levels of industry. These are the main sources. And so if you're in those immediate vicinities, that's where you're going to have the worst air pollution.
But in the outer suburbs, the outer rings, as we sometimes call them, in the area, whether you're in Westlake or, let's say, Shaker Heights or Solon.
Yeah, so you should still pay attention to the air quality index, even if you are in the outer suburbs. So if you're in the outer suburbs and you see that air quality index value or that alert that day, you still need to pay attention to it. But the greater concentration of where we're going to see poor air quality is going to be within the areas that have high transportation and industry.
And you mentioned to me in a previous conversation leading up to this, one of your areas where you monitor quality, that's kind of the worst.
Yeah, so we have a monitoring site located on Harvard Avenue. And that site, one of the pollutants that it collects is something called particulate matter. And that site is pretty significant in terms of it is the highest PM site in the state of Ohio.
And why is particulate matter bad to be breathing?
Yeah, so these are just like small particles that are in the air. And the smaller it is, it gets deeper into your body. And the deeper it gets into your body, the more trouble it can cause. But specifically, something like asthma, it inflames the lungs. So if you already have a cardiovascular condition or respiratory condition, it's going to make it just harder for you to breathe.
Okay. So Beth, in Akron, what Christina is describing as some of the problematic aspects of the air quality in this region, what is your view on what's happening in Akron and where the trouble areas are?
Yes, thank you for that question. So because of about a century of environmentally racist urban planning decisions, high industrial areas in the city of Akron are concentrated within Black and low-income neighborhoods. So specifically, when you look at East Akron, the topography of the neighborhood is like a bowl, and the air quality really kind of lives there a little bit longer than, you know, in other areas of the city. And there's such a concentration of industrialization there that it really creates a huge accumulative impact on people's health disparity rates within the neighborhood.
And so in some respects, you're saying the history, as I said in my intro, of redlining and the way homes and highways and industry was all planted into a particular region, it still affects how people breathe today.
Certainly. We see higher rates of asthma. And the reality is that these pollutants, especially things that we've been finding in local smokestacks of benzene and vinyl chloride and dioxins, have larger health effects, you know, affecting reproductive systems, nervous systems, respiratory, certainly, and pulmonary circulation within residents of these areas.
Tom, you're our tree expert. I'm sure there's a couple more on this panel, but it is in your job description. It is what you do. When we talk about historically redlined communities, when we talk about colors of communities of color in Akron and Cleveland that are hardest hit with kids with much higher rates of asthma, what does tree canopy have to do with that? How does that come into play? And do you think it's a real big part of this conversation when we talk about air quality and breathability?
Oh, absolutely. I think, it's those poor health outcomes in communities of color, they're visible from space, right? If we take a look at a Google map, right, of where the trees are, where the green spaces in the city in our region are, people are going to be healthier in those areas. And if you just overlay sort of asthma rates or, cardiovascular disease, really any negative health outcome, you're going to see, first of all, it follows those redlining maps. And then you're going to see this strong correlation with where there are trees and aren't trees.
And do you think historically, I don't know if you know this answer, but were there trees there at one point and then they're pulled out so you can build a plant or a company or a highway or things of that nature? Or were the trees never put in?
Oh, that's an awesome question and a complicated one. In a lot of cases, they were never put in. I mean, trees in cities are different than trees in the forest, right? A tree in the forest grows wherever it can. In the city, it's all concrete, right? So we have to design spaces for trees. And in, you know, some of our communities, you'll see there aren't tree lawns, or the tree lawns are paved over, or the tree lawn's only, you know, 1 foot deep. But if you go to sort of wealthier white communities, you'll see there's lots of spaces designed to be, you know, canopy.
Let's go ahead and take a call from Tim, who's calling in from Hinckley this morning. Tim, good morning.
Hey, good morning. Hey, I'm helping farmers out in Hinckley with their land, and they've got some monster vines. I'm cutting them now for their, I guess, their CAUV entitlement. Is that helping with, you know, air quality and keeping the trees healthy and yada, yada?
Tom, I'll turn that question to you if you think you know an answer.
Well, it definitely depends on the vine. I think it's pretty complicated. I'd probably want to defer to a forester, not an urban forester, to answer that question. But anything that's helping that tree live, survive, and provide canopy is helping air quality. And so if you're removing invasive vines, things that were going to strangle or parasite to the tree, then that's fantastic and certainly will have an impact on air quality.
Christina, let's talk about asthma in kids. I've already kind of referred to the higher rates, but the numbers that you gave me were stark for the rates of asthma amongst children in certain parts of Cleveland. So why don't you elaborate on that?
Yeah. So what we see within the city of Cleveland is that there's some neighborhoods that have asthma rates, pediatric asthma rates, around 23% to 25%. And when you look at the national average, it's around 8% to 10%. So it's pretty significant within the city of Cleveland. And one of the things that we see is how this relates to the redlining is that there is an area in the city of Cleveland called the Cleveland Crescent. So basically, if you look at any social vulnerability index, you look at any poor health outcome, there's a C throughout the city of Cleveland. So Northeast Cleveland down through Central down to Southeast, and then a near West Side location. This C follows the historical redlining maps for our area. And although pediatric asthma rates, as we discussed, is significantly higher in certain neighborhoods, it's within that C that we're going to see the highest levels. And one of the things that Beth mentioned was cumulative impacts, and she's absolutely right about that, is that there's the outdoor air pollution that is impacting asthma rates or likely impacting asthma rates, but also all the other stressors that these residents are dealing with as a result of this historical practice.
And what I was struck by in speaking to both you and Beth prior to this conversation is that there are studies that are still needing to happen. I kind of assume the studies have happened. We already know. But Beth, well, tell me a little bit about the work that you're doing to better understand these cumulative impacts and just generally the air quality in what you talked about, that bowl of East Cleveland that is heavily co-populated by people and by industry.
Yes, and East Akron. We are starting to look at smokestack records of industry within that neighborhood and also really helping to push a native and edible plant giveaway as well for businesses and nonprofits within and schools within that neighborhood to try and meet our tree canopy needs to both sequester the air that is in the area, but then also to really look at the responsibility of industry within that neighborhood. We find that a lot of these issues are things that have been affecting this neighborhood for a long time. We, in February, had a meeting with the US EPA talking about a cumulative impact in which they really made it known that through their new environmental justice wing is where they're starting to deal with a cumulative impact, but it's not something that the EPA has really fully delved into. They're used to dealing with one toxin at a time. Mm. And that's just not how it affects people's bodies and how it affects their lives. So we're really trying to be on the forefront of advocating for neighbors around how this actually shows up in their lives and affects their families long term.
Tom, let's talk about the initiative from the Western Reserve Land Conservancy. It's a whole program with the aim to reforest the city. So tell us about the program and all the ways in which you've already started to grow and really kind of cultivate trees in Cleveland.
Yeah, thanks so much. I mean, a healthy tree canopy for a city, you want coverage of about 30 to 40%. So if you're looking from space, you want to see green over about 30 to 40% of the canopy. In Cleveland, we're at 18% and declining. So our mission is to reverse that trend, is simply to build canopy in the city, you know, that we desperately need. And, you know, we do that three ways. One, by growing trees. We use the term growing, not planting, because we care for our trees for 3 years after we put them in the ground. We water them every summer. And then sometime in that first 6 years, we're training the trees so that they have a proper form and won't create problems for people and for the city in the future. And then we also advocate for mature trees. I have the privilege of sitting on Cleveland's Tree Commission, and my staff and team train folks in the community to be tree stewards and to advocate for trees in their communities as well.
And tell me about some of the neighborhoods where you've already planted trees and what kind of the results or anything that you're seeing arise from that.
Gosh, yeah. I mean, when I got into this work, I thought, you know, I'm working for generations in the future, right?
Sure.
But there is sort of an instant impact that happens when you add trees to a space. So, you know, we see in the communities that we work in that, you know, folks just find the spaces where we're planting trees more welcoming. And I think that's intuitive to all of us. I mean, if listeners just think for just a moment about a tree in their life where they grew up, right, or a tree in their life now, generally speaking, if you just take a moment, take a deep breath and think about that tree, it's a positive feeling,
sure,
right? And so, you know, we're bringing that. It's a little intangible and a little less quantifiable than, you know, the air pollutants that we're removing, than the, you know, heat that we're removing, and that the long-term effects of these trees and the benefits of these trees are. But, you know, immediately we see that, you know, folks in neighborhoods appreciate just the beauty that trees bring and, you know, the sort of well-being, I think that's intuitive for that we all kind of feel.
Well, I think everyone needs a relationship with nature in whatever that capacity is. So I think sometimes even just a tree is representative of kind of that goodwill you feel when you see nature generally. Where are you working now to plant more trees?
Gosh, I'm so excited. Over the next 2 days, we'll add 100 trees in the St. Clair Superior neighborhood. And, you know, last year we worked a lot in the Buckeye Shaker, Buckeye Woodhill, and Slavic Village neighborhoods. So, you know, we're really focused on, you know, Cleveland's historically disinvested neighborhoods. We know that that's where the trees are needed the most.
Travis in an email asked, do trees losing their leaves every year make a noticeable impact on air quality? Is air quality better in summer when canopies are full? Is that something that you can take a stab at, Tom?
Well, the beautiful thing about leaves falling in the fall is that all of the particulate matter, that PMI we were talking about, that bad dust and dirt that gets into your lungs, they're getting kind of captured on the leaves. Like if you touch a leaf, you know, you see it's kind of smooth. Sometimes it's a little fuzzy on the bottom side. It's just a giant filter waving in the wind, just collecting that dust. And then when it falls in the fall, it's just dropping that into the soil. So it's, you know, you're shortcutting the air and shortcutting your lungs in that case. So I can't really speak to the, you know, whether or not the air quality is actually worse in the
winter.
In the winter, but it's necessary to get those air pollutants out of the air for the leaves to fall.
And you also explained to me that trees have so many other ways in which we don't think about that are beneficial. The respirators, mm-hmm. They soak up water after heavy rainstorms, which helps even our lake.
Absolutely. Yeah, I could talk for 10 hours about the benefits of trees.
In 5 minutes. and everyone else gets a turn. No,
yeah, you know, I like to think, you know, on a hot summer day, right, you know, there are places in the city where you can walk, you know, from, say, Shaker Heights into Cleveland and feel, you know, 5, 6, 7 degrees of temperature difference.
Wow.
that's dangerous, right? And it's very tangible to, you know, sort of experience those differences. And the trees aren't just shading us from solar radiation, right? That's the kind of obvious thing. They're blocking the sun from hitting the concrete. And so they're not heating up the city and then releasing that heat all night and then getting heated up. It's not being reheat. So that umbrella effect, that sort of shade that it's providing, is sort of the most obvious thing. But they're also respirating. They're like putting little droplets of air, water out into the air. I think about like if you're in line for a roller coaster at Cedar Point and the sun's just baking on you, it's super hot. Sometimes they put those fans out with a little mister.
Sure.
Cools the air, makes it easier to breathe, that's what trees are doing, right? They're just kind of cooling the air all around them. And of course, the more you link together, the more that cumulative effect, the more canopy you have, the more air is just becoming more pleasant and easier to be in.
Beth, with the Big Love Network in Akron, I know that you're going to have a table at this week's weekend's event that Keep Akron Beautiful is putting on to essentially long-term plant 100,000 trees by 2034. But I understand that, you know, one of the issues in Akron is a lot of the land is privately owned. So in some ways, education and trying to get private citizens to kind of join the tree movement is really important.
Yes, and we're really blessed that we have a great coalition of different partners throughout the community working on this goal. So one of the collaborative tables that we sit at is with the Summit of Sustainability Alliance, Life on Land Group. And I helped chair that subcommittee. And we are able to kind of pool all of our different partners together to work towards a common goal. I wanted to circulate back to something that was said about percentage of tree canopy. And Akron for a long time has created its percentage for tree canopy as its longer term goal. But we're starting to reevaluate that because we're like, if we just add more trees to neighborhoods that already have trees to get our goal accomplished, are we really getting our goal accomplished?
Right.
Or should our goals be focused on the historically redlined neighborhoods that really need this impact? And so that's where we're starting to change and shift our perspective and really work collaboratively to achieve.
Christina, we have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask you two questions. One is from Darren Hamm, who emails, I'd be interested to know how they are helping protect a healthy, sustainable tree canopy with the Ohio Department of Transportation and the public utility companies who can consider trees hazardous or obstructions to their services. I guess, Tom, this might be directed at you as well, but how do you deal with the Department of Transportation or utility companies when it comes to tree canopy and who kind of has control over that?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. You know, I think that industry is changing in a lot of ways. I think there's a lot of education that's gone out to people who prune for utilities about properly pruning trees so that the, you know, trees can have all kinds of forms in the forest and still be healthy, right? So I think it's you know, a good thing that the industry is starting to learn how to sort of prune and care for trees and have them intersect our infrastructure. From a personal perspective, I know our infrastructure is going to be different in the future, right? I don't think, you know, some of the trees I'm planting will be around in 150 years, 200 years. I cannot imagine that we're still going to receive electricity and gas and utilities the same way in 150 years that we have today. So, you know, I'm focused on making sure that the trees are there for future generations to manage those conflicts and negotiate those needs.
Then, Christina, I'll ask you this question. You know, as a part of the enforcement arm when it comes to air quality at the Cleveland Health Department, do you think corporations and industry is changing when it comes to their perspective on environmental and health impacts of their companies? And do you think the work that you do is in fact having a greater impact on making sure the public is safe and healthy if they are living amongst industry?
So I think that there is a lot going on that is like a trickling effect. So we mentioned cumulative impacts a couple of times. There's a lot, just a resource yesterday that was released by the Biden-Harris administration for environmental justice. And there are new guidelines in terms of like how industry should be interacting with the public when it comes to environmental justice and being a good neighbor. So I do believe, I don't have the numbers, that you see more and more big industry looking at corporate sustainability initiatives, looking at community benefit initiatives, because it's good for them. It makes business sense, and it's better for all around. And they can possibly see like a good return on investment in some of their actions. From an enforcement standpoint, one of the things that our office does is we regulate the industry that's local. And what we are regulating is based off of the state rules and the federal rules. So as the state rules change and the federal rules change, then that changes what we can and are able to do. So I do think that a lot of this is much more in the forefront of the conversation now. We're seeing more guidance documents from the state and federal governments on how we should be enforcing and what types of rules and regulations we should be and interacting with, but there's still work. There's still work that needs to get done.
And we will continue following your work and hopefully have you on again. Christina Yoka with the Cleveland Health Department, Tom Scheiber with the Western Reserve Land Conservancy, and Beth Vild with Big Love Network. Thank you all for this conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we had an email from Tom I want to read real quickly just now. We talk about food deserts in urban neighborhoods. How many of those trees being planted are fruit trees? We could solve two problems with each tree. Community orchard, how about it? And I think, Beth, that's something that you've spoken to me about, using fruit trees in order to kill two birds with one stone. So thank you all again. Time for a quick break. When we return, we're going to have a conversation with the Deputy Administrator of USAID, Mark Simakowski. We're going to talk about the Russian war with Ukraine and aid going to Ukraine. I'm Jenny Hamill. This is The Sound of Ideas. We'll be right back. You're with The Sound of Ideas from IdeaStream Public Media. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks so much for staying with us. The Russian invasion of Ukraine over 2 years ago continues to hit close to home for many in Ohio, which has the sixth largest population of people with Ukrainian ancestry in the U.S., more than 40,000 and more than 4,000 of those living in Parma here in Northeast Ohio. Ohio has also helped to resettle more than 5,000 Ukrainians since this war began. A massive U.S. aid package was just passed this week after months of delay by Congress that will send $61 billion to Ukraine to help in the war that has killed more than 30,000 Ukrainian military members. That's according to Ukrainian President Zelensky, who also estimated the loss of tens of thousands of civilians as of February. Today, Ohio native and USAID Deputy Administrator Mark Simakowski is in town to talk with members of the Ukrainian community in Ohio about what the U.S. is doing to help provide humanitarian assistance to people who have been displaced or impacted by the war. USAID stands for United States Agency for International Development and is an independent federal agency. Mark joins us in studio to discuss these efforts. Mark, thanks for stopping by.
Thanks so much for having me, Jenny. It's an honor to be here and I'm back in Ohio.
Welcome to your home state.
Exactly.
If you'd like to join the conversation or have a question, you can call us 866-578-0903. You can email us at soi@ideastream.org, or you can tweet us. We're at Sound of Ideas. Mark, the federal government just passed this massive aid package that advocates of Ukraine have been calling for months. Can you give me a little more context and tell us how this huge amount of funding is going to help in the state of things in Ukraine from a humanitarian perspective?
Absolutely. So over the last 6 months, obviously the Congress has been considering providing additional assistance to Ukraine. The war in Ukraine continues after 2.5 years. Ukraine is facing an unbelievable amount of pressure from the Russian Federation as attacks escalate. Territory in Ukraine obviously is under threat, and Ukraine, despite being successful in retaking half the territory that Russia occupied since February of 2022, they're at their back heels. Russia's willing to maim and kill hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians, attack Ukrainian cities, so the United States government has been very focused, and the Biden administration has been very focused on providing the assistance that Ukraine needs to defend itself against Russian aggression, but also the assistance required to ensure that Ukraine can remain resilient at home while it fights a war on the front lines. And so in four previous national security supplementals, requests for assistance, in a bipartisan basis, the Congress and the American people have been focused on providing Ukraine support. And so this latest supplemental essentially is a reflection of the assistance that we've provided. So military assistance will be a component of this supplemental package, humanitarian assistance to give the Ukrainian people, about half are taking in humanitarian assistance, but also development assistance and budget support to ensure that the Ukrainian economy can stand up as it's facing attacks, and also so the Ukrainian people, their energy sector, their agriculture sector, their infrastructure can be supported in a way that ensures that the economy can stand up on its own two feet and be less reliant. So this package essentially provides assistance for the United States to provide Ukraine. A lot of this funding, the $61 billion that you mentioned, a majority of it is actually staying at home because the United States provides Ukraine military assistance, which it then uses this funding to replenish stocks of military assistance here in the United States, with companies not only in the United States, but in Ohio as well. So this is not simply a blank check of $61 billion to Ukraine. Much of this funding, again, stays in the United States, but a portion of it, of course, is going to Ukraine so it can maintain its resiliency and defend itself to support U.S. interests in Ukraine.
So when you talk about humanitarian assistance, because I do think it's important to kind of get into the minutiae of how you're helping Ukrainians on the ground in Ukraine as they are fighting a war. And one of the things that you were talking about is so that society can maintain and exist as it is. And I understand that some of the funding even goes to help with the teachers remaining in classrooms to teach kids in Ukraine.
That's absolutely right. There's three pillars of the work that USAID is doing in Ukraine. The first is humanitarian assistance. So we're providing funding for things like destroyed water systems. We're providing funding for people that essentially need healthcare systems in Ukraine. We're providing funding for emergency needs in frontline communities that have been destroyed. So, you know, through the United Nations, through areas like United Children's Christian Fund, we're essentially providing assistance where the most hard-hit communities are getting the most immediate humanitarian assistance that they need. So in addition, we're providing what's called direct budget support. So that direct budget support is provided on a reimbursable basis. So the Ukrainian government is paying all of its public sector workers, healthcare workers, teachers, first responders. They're paying their salaries, and then as a result, so the Ukrainian government can prioritize and focus all of its resources on the war effort. 100% of Ukrainian tax revenue is spent on essentially fighting the war. We reimburse the Ukrainian government for those public sector salaries and support. So in many ways, our assistance, our budget support, is paying teacher salaries, it's paying healthcare workers, it's paying the first responders that are there on the ground, so the Ukrainian government can essentially stay solvent economically and their economy can be maintained. The other area of support is what I mentioned in terms of when Russia bombs Ukraine's energy grid, and every single day Russia is bombing Ukraine's energy grid with the intent to try to destroy Ukrainian economy and destroy the lights, so people will essentially will flee Ukraine and the government will sue for peace. We are helping to repair that energy grid. The agriculture sector has been devastated both because of Russia's attempt to blockade the Black Sea ports.
Wow.
So we're helping the agriculture sector open new export routes. We're helping Ukrainian farmers ensure that they can remain solvent by providing them grants, so and providing them storage and providing them things like seeds and fertilizer. In addition, we're helping small and medium enterprises in Ukraine so they can essentially create tax revenue that will allow the government to be less reliant. The other thing we're doing is we are watching our assistance in a way like a hawk. So we are ensuring that all the assistance that the U.S. taxpayer is providing to Ukraine, that the Ukrainian government is accountable. So we have set a system in place where we are creating an incredible amount of scrutiny over how those funds are used. And then lastly, Ukraine has to win not only the war, it has to win the peace. Ukraine has to become transformed as a result not only of the devastation wrought by Russia's invasion, but also by our assistance. So we're helping the Ukrainians reform in a way that will help them become a more transparent and non-corrupt government that's able to integrate in the EU, and that's a real focus of what we're doing in Ukraine.
I'm curious, as someone who is so versed and so kind of entrenched in what's happening in Ukraine, have you noticed that so much less attention was put on the Ukrainian people defending themselves against Russia when everything in Israel and Gaza started to escalate? I think the public consumption for what was happening internationally was really focused on one area. What was your perspective of that?
You know, I think one thing I've been struck by is the amount of American support for the plight that Ukraine sees itself in today. You know, particularly in Ohio, which this community is essentially been shaped by insecurity in Europe for centuries. Ohioans understand physically what it means to have war and instability. You have huge Polish communities here who have fled challenges in Europe over the last 100 years. Ukrainian communities. My parents were immigrants from the Soviet Union that settled in Ohio, made this community their home. So I'm always struck by when you go through the streets in Ohio, you see Ukrainian flags. And yes, I do think after 2.5 years of war in Ukraine, an immense amount of resources that the United States has committed to Ukraine, there's naturally fatigue and questions, particularly when events around the world are escalating in places like Israel and Gaza and Asia as well. But again, I think that there clearly still is real support for Ukraine, and the reflection of the Congress just this week supporting another significant amount of funding with the president signing into law, I think showcases that there are still issues that Americans can rally behind and supporting their Ukrainians in their fight for freedom and also pushing back on Russian aggression is in the U.S. interest, and it's something that Americans understand, but we need to do a better job of communicating why it's important. But again, when I speak to communities here, you can still see a clear, consistent focus that this is something that Americans should stand by and support as long as there is an end state and an achievable victory potentially for Ukraine.
So later today, you're going to meet with representatives from the United Ukrainian Organizations of Ohio, as well as other diaspora organizations focused on the invasion of Ukraine. How important is it to get input from people in our local communities about the conflict and war abroad who might be refugees or have family still in Ukraine? Are you getting information from them, or are they receiving from you, or is it a two-way street there?
It's absolutely a two-way street. I think, you know, there clearly are not only so many communities that are sympathetic to the plight of what is going on in Ukraine, to the Ukrainian people, they're standing up to help and support. So you have communities here that have provided millions of dollars of humanitarian assistance to Ukraine. People are volunteering. You know, I was just in Ukraine a few weeks ago, and I met with others that are on the ground providing humanitarian assistance, buying ambulances, providing food and shelter. So you still see a groundswell of American support. So my interest has been to get out of Washington, get out of the Beltway bubble that exists, and to just hear from Americans what their concerns are about the sustainment of American assistance, to understand where USAID can work better with local communities to maximize and leverage their willingness to support, and also to hear from them and hear their concerns. You know, I think one of the incredible strengths of the United States is the government is obviously involved in support, but local communities and the private sector is involved as well. So we understand that the United States can't be the lead in Ukrainian recovery and rebuilding. And actually, the United States is not. We have 50 countries around the world that are contributing to Ukraine's needs, who are providing more assistance to Ukraine than in the United States. And also, the private sector has stepped up. I was really proud last week. The Ukrainian Prime Minister was in Washington, and we were able to announce that NASDAQ is willing to waive the listing of fees for Ukrainian companies that are going to list on NASDAQ. Bank of America is volunteered to provide their own staff to the Ukrainian government to help them plan for recovery in Ukraine. So you see, again, through USAID's engagement with the private sector, with local communities, that we can strengthen what we're doing in Ukraine to give them the best possible chance for victory. And I'm really excited to go to Parma to hear from this Ukrainian community that honestly has much more connectivity back to Ukraine with their roots and their families and their traditions, to give us some advice at USAID on where and how we can do better in supporting Ukraine.
One interesting aspect of how you're helping in Ukraine as a journalist of interest to me is the aid is also supporting free press and to counter information manipulation. Can you talk a little more about that?
Absolutely. So USAID has been in Ukraine for over 30 years, and the goal of our assistance has been to create a democratic society that can stand on its own and be resilient to not only foreign aggression, but the corruption and a authoritarian model that Russia represents. So we are very focused on reform in Ukraine. And part of that reform is to build the institutions that we here in the United States sometimes take for granted. So the free and independent press that you mentioned is an incredible tool of being an oversight over the Ukrainian government. So when there were challenges with inside the military, that there was essentially some elements of corruption with eggs, it was the journalism community and civil society that called those challenges to bear and described them. So we need to build and help build an independent press in Ukraine, and that one exists. In addition, we're helping the Ukrainian government build anti-corruption institutions and a judiciary that's independent from government influence and can essentially create the confidence for the private sector to invest in Ukraine. So these reforms that USAID is providing, we do it through technical assistance where we have partners on the ground. We obviously provide some funding that we really are seeking to support these pillars of civil society engagement that can create the kind of institutions that, again, can transform Ukraine so it is a member of the EU and can serve also as a key partner for the United States and is not the Ukraine that is corrupt and authoritarian that it's been in its past.
So you're from Ohio.
That's right.
Born
in Columbus.
In Columbus. You're an Ohio guy. I'm sure you're based in D.C. You travel all around the world. It's the focus of your job. When you come here to the greater Cleveland area, does a trip talking to Ohioans who are impacted by the conflict that you're working so intimately on, does that hold special meaning for you?
You know, it does. I was born in Ohio. My parents raised two children in Ohio, myself and my sister. They never left Ohio when they came. And the reason for it is they found a community that cares, that supported them when they immigrated. A community that was like them, made up of a melting pot of Americans from not only Europe, but around the world. My sister lives in Columbus. She's an immigration attorney that helps also new arrivals come. So I've always been struck by the social fabric of Ohio as a place. If you worked hard, no matter where you came from, you contributed to your community and you gave back. That it was a place that showcased the best of the United States. And Cleveland is just an example of that. You know, this community has hosted Ukrainians that have fled Russia's devastation in Ukraine. They've been willing to give back. And so in many ways, to me, Ohio represents the best of America. I wish I could move back here. My wife would love to move back to Ohio. It really is the best of what America can bring, but also the best in showcasing that this community has the resources and the willingness to keep the United States engaged in the world and to push back on foreign aggression so there is not further floods of immigrants coming from Europe and other places that are facing devastation. So, again, I think this is really at the forefront of where we should be listening to Americans. And Americans also have concerns about the length of this war and whether we should continue to support Ukraine. You know, the challenge, of course, is Russia is ambitions are not focused solely on Ukraine. Russia is seeking to restore its imperial ambitions all over Europe. There's countries like Moldova that are at threat, the Baltic states, Poland. So we have to stop Putin, ensure his strategic failure in Ukraine so this aggression doesn't expand to other countries. And the United States has to provide not only the treasure that it's providing, but potentially blood through American soldiers in Ukraine.
USA Deputy Administrator Mark Simakovsky, thanks so much, and thanks for coming in today and speaking to us about the work that you do.
Thank you.
Now, to get the last word on today's topic, send an email to soi@ideastream.org on Twitter, now X at Sound of Ideas. You can follow me at @JennyHamill_. Tomorrow on the Sound of Ideas, it's the Friday Reporters Roundtable with Mike McIntyre. If you missed any portion of the program, find us online or listen to the Sound of Ideas podcast. I'm Jenny Hamill. Thanks for listening. I'll speak with you on Monday.